Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Little risk and cheap loans. That's essentially the offer the Obama administration is making to private investors to try to get them to buy as much as $1 trillion in toxic assets from banks. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner announced this public-private investment program today. The plan would give investors low-interest loans to buy mortgage-backed securities that are clogging up banks' balance sheets. The government would assume most of the risk if those assets lose value. Joining us on the line is Barry Ritholtz, CEO of Fusion IQ, an equity research firm. Welcome, Barry.
Thanks for having me.
We know from the past that nobody wanted to buy these toxic assets, primarily because nobody knew what they were worth. How is the White House trying to deal with that this time around?
Well, essentially, the White House is trying to make this as risk-free to investors as possible. What we see the private sector putting up is somewhere between 3 and 5%, which potentially gives them a lot of upside.
So private investors would have to put up relatively little of their own money. The Treasury Department gave this example. Say a bank has an asset that it values at about $100 and it goes to auction. The top bidder gets it for $84. The investor would only have to put up $6 of their own money. The rest would come from government loans or equity.
That's right. And remember, in theory, these things could return to par. The real problem with this is that we're taking assets that we know to be rather junky and trying to get the prices up. To be blunt, I don't know who the hell is going to be bidding $84 for these. We don't know what the value is. We know it's not zero, but we're also pretty damn sure it's not 100. I wouldn't be surprised to see bids clustered in the 30, 35, 40 cent range.
So do you think the banks would go along with that 30, 35, 40 cent range?
That's really the question. If they don't go along with the 34 cents and the economy continues to be mired in this crisis, the next step will be to temporarily nationalize the bank, wipe out the shareholders, and just strip all this junk off the balance sheets. And that means they'll get 0 cents on the dollar. So they're choosing between nothing and little versus holding it until the cows come home and they could get anywhere near 100 cents on the dollar.
Now, what about strings attached? We certainly know that there's been some talk about using the AIG anger as a possible example here, that some investors might say, you know what, I'm concerned that there could be public anger if this doesn't work, and I don't want my dollar, you know, to be the one on the table and then have Congress come after me or have some sort of law passed that maybe retroactively might affect my business.
That's a very legitimate concern. Look, we keep taking our eye off the ball, and as egregious and offensive as the AIG bonuses were, you know, it was less than 1% of the total bailout money. Talk about losing sight of the forest for the trees. That's one issue. The second issue is, look, if you want to buy a house or buy a car or start a business, the odds are that you're going to need a healthy flow of credit. And right now that credit flow is dramatically constricted. So I hate the thought of rewarding really, really bad behavior, be it in bonuses or making these banks whole. You know, let's not forget, these banks were ineptly run by management that didn't understand how to control risk. They lost billions of dollars, and I hate the thought of giving them any sort of money to undo their bad decisions. It's their losses, not the taxpayers. But something has to be done to work this out. Again, my preference is, you know, shoot them all, let God sort them out. You nationalize the ones that are technically insolvent, you fire the management, and you essentially reboot and start over. If this plan doesn't work, that's where we're eventually going. The longer we wait, the more expensive it's going to be.
You think it's going to eventually end up doing that anyway?
You know, you put your finger on exactly the issue with this plan. If people are bidding 20, 30, 40 cents, the banks won't sell it. If the banks are waiting for 80, 85, 90 cents, nobody in their right mind is going to be bidding that, even with the government subsidy and the non-recourse loans. So unless the banks have their come-to-Jesus moment and say, I'll take a 50% haircut and be done with this, unless that change in psychology takes place, we're likely to see this be as unsuccessful as all the prior attempts,
What about regulations? I wonder if it's not only AIG bonuses. Could the White House possibly sweeten this deal for private investors by saying, you know, we will promise you that there will not be increased regulation in exchange for your investment?
You know, they could promise the Tooth Fairy is going to leave $1 million under everybody's pillow, but that ain't going to happen either. Look, we got into this problem due to a number of reasons. But clearly, the failure of moderate regulation to oversee Wall Street has a lot to do with this. And to basically make a rescue of the banking sector contingent upon more of the same that got us into this, I just don't see how politically that's going to happen. I think there's just far too much anger amongst the population to say, yeah, those guys on Wall Street, we can let them self-police because they've done such a great job with it.
All right. Well, Barry Ritholtz, CEO of Fusion IQ. His forthcoming book is called Bailout Nation. Barry, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Another White House proposal to improve the economy is through education and increasing the rate at which students graduate from high school. The challenge is daunting, especially in urban high schools, where in some cases 50% of the students don't graduate on time. But a school in Worcester, Massachusetts is defying those odds, and other schools around the country are taking note. The University Park Campus School is a public school located in the poorest section of Worcester near Clark University. Clark says improving the area outside its gates will benefit the university as well as its neighbors. So Clark provides student volunteers, the use of some campus facilities, and the promise that those University Park students who meet Clark's admission standards will be able to go to college there for free. Clark provides no money to the school. It's funded like all the other public schools in Worcester. And in the 11 years since University Park opened, every student has not only graduated, but gone on to post-secondary education. We visited University Park, which is in an unassuming, rather run-down former Worcester Elementary School. Instead of things such as computer labs and sports fields, there's a lot of enthusiasm. Anthony Hodges is a freshman.
When I started this school, it was hard. Because, like, they pile homework on you. And see me, if I went to a different school, probably been a bad boy. Because I used to be a troublemaker in elementary. You should always, like, playing around, never doing homework. And once you come here, they just force you, like, you want to go to college, you got to do this, this, that, and you can make it.
We asked Ricky Hall, the coordinator of the University Park Campus School, why his school is so successful.
I think first and foremost, it's our shared and collective mission of student success here. I think all the teachers and staff bring to the school a genuine belief that all students can succeed and all students will go to college. And from the moment they walk in here in grade 7, that's our promise to them. And that becomes a driving force, a driving cultural force in the building. And everything is towards that end. So their rigorous academic coursework is to that end, but also their behavioral and academic and civic expectations are to that end. Kids take tough courses here. They don't have a choice on what kind of course they take. They take all honors courses. All those courses are the core academic areas.
A lot of folks might say, well, doesn't that happen at every school?
Well, I think
it should.
It should. And in the good schools, it does. I think our smallness is another major factor here because we only have 240 students or so. We have 17 teachers here. And so everybody feels like we're a family. And much of it is, you know, kind of us against the world kind of mentality. You know, we know that there are challenges here, but collectively we can overcome them. What makes this place different is it's the same material being taught in other schools. It's just being taught really well here. I mean, it's being taught by expert teachers who love kids, who love their content area, and work really hard to make sure that they, you know, bring that love to their students.
A lot of the reasons that we hear, the factors that we hear of why kids drop out are poverty, English language learners, mobility, people moving around a lot, not a lot of family support at home. It seems like you have all of those factors, and yet you're defying the odds.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have some kids that have all those factors you just listed. We have some kids that have some of them. I think every kid has at least one for the most part. But yeah, poverty, we have ELL students, we have special ed students, We have the same group of factors, and yet we consistently see, you know, very strong academic success. It's not just the instruction, but that's a big part of it. I mean, I think part of it also is that kids come here and recognize that we're just not going to let you fail. You know, and it's not just that we won't accept you to fail, we won't accept you not succeeding. I mean, it's just not a matter of getting you through high school, but beyond that, it's getting you into college, it's getting you through college. There's a general misconception about the school that we cream the crop or take the best academically most talented students in the city, and that is the reason why we're successful. But in reality, our kids come here challenged as a population, generally reading below grade level, doing math below grade level. As a rule, we're getting kids who are coming relatively depleted academically and challenged academically. Our role in grade 7 and 8 is to do a lot of wraparound academic and social services to kind of get them up to speed to be able to make access to a rigorous 9th grade curriculum. So 7th and 8th grade is kind of this very intense kind of bolstering the, you know, the skills that are needed for high school success. And then by grade 9, they're taking a full slate of honors level courses.
Kids get in by a lottery.
That's right. Yeah. So every year we accept 44 new 7th graders. The only admissions application requirement is that they live within a defined district around Clark University that Clark defines around the school.
Now, is that something that parents have to sign up for, or how do people get in the lottery? So I'm wondering, if are you dealing with a fairly committed group of parents that
yeah,
at that
that's
point?
A good question. We send out notification to all the students in our Worcester Public School system that show an address on the defined streets, explaining to them that there's an informational meeting that they need to come to where they fill out the application. And so that's as much as we require of them. We don't require any other things other than to show up to that informational meeting and fill out a very short application. The application is merely name, address, telephone number, that kind of thing. We don't take test scores or anything like that. I think we do have some selective process there that, you know, parents have to physically come, you know, to the meeting and fill out the application.
Do you think that this model can be replicated in other places?
I get nervous when people want to just come here and take it like a, you know, a cookie cutter and move it somewhere else and try to use the exact same model, because, you know, I think the school's success is by virtue of not just its design principles, but also by the human beings who are here. That being said, I think there are some clear, important lessons that come out of this school's success that, if taken properly and used properly, I think could, in fact, really make people retool their understanding of how urban education is done. It's not just some people have tried to figure it out by saying, well, it's the smallness, right? It's the smallness that makes a difference. So we're just going to make all of our big schools small. Well, that's not the only component of our success here. It's one, but it's not the only component. And when it doesn't end up being successful, they throw their hands up and go, I can't figure out why this doesn't work. Well, it's not just smallness. It's part of it. So if it were done really thoughtfully, and someone came in and really said, let's look at these design principles, let's try to replicate what makes sense for another school, you know, and really dive into what makes it successful here, I think it could be replicated. But this quick fix, magic pill, will make it small, that's the reason why it's successful, I don't think that's something that actually would work.
Ricky Hall is with University Park Campus School. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Part of President Obama's plan to reform the nation's healthcare system involves computerizing medical records. His economic stimulus plan includes $19 billion to expand the use of electronic medical records in doctors' offices. He says this will save jobs, lives, and billions of dollars. The president also says that centers should be set up to help doctors' offices go digital. One such center already operating is the Primary Care Information Project in New York City, which works with 1,000 doctors and 1 million patients, many of them from low-income households. The project is run by Dr. Farzad Mostashari, the assistant commissioner in the New York City Health Department. He says the primary goal of information technology is to save lives. And Dr. Mostashari, is there evidence to suggest that electronic medical records do save lives?
There's plenty of evidence that you can't really go into a 21st century healthcare system without health IT being central to that transformation. So some of our real role models here are the integrated delivery network systems like Kaiser. Kaiser has made amazing progress in terms of providing high-quality, affordable health care, and the health IT has been absolutely central to that. One example of that is their amazing reduction in the number one preventable killer of Americans, which is heart disease, where they have now reduced that dramatically over the past few years, and it's now the second leading cause of death in the Kaiser system.
You know, I also read the study from Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh. They had automated prescribing recommendations in a commercial electronic record system, and they said that there was a threefold increase in the death rate among children there after that happened. So is the jury still out, if you will, as to whether this actually does save lives?
I don't think there's any serious debate that, for example, around medication safety, that health records overall improve the safety of healthcare compared to the handwritten, scrawled prescriptions that that account for some 80,000 deaths a year in our country. I think that the point, though, is well taken, that technology is really an amplifier and an enabler. And we can't really expect to implement technology and expect it to work magic on its own.
What about the folks who might say, you know, medicine is a personal, private business. It's one person caring for another person. And using electronic medical records, while on one front certainly seems like it may be a way to sort of streamline things and make it easier for teams to deal with a particular patient, on the other hand, that sort of human observation that's often needed in medicine can be overlooked.
It's a really good point. And what we don't want is to have the technology come in between the doctor and the patient. It doesn't have to be that way. There are some practices who implement it in a way where it's like a triangle, where the health record really becomes a tool for helping communication between the patient and the provider. Look at the graph of what your blood pressure has done since you've been on this new medication, or look at what's going on with your triglycerides as your weight has increased. So those are the tools. You know, we can't simply digitize our existing processes, what in Boston they call paving the cow paths, I understand. We have to make use of the technology to actually improve every aspect of the interaction.
Mm. And what about privacy, which is obviously an issue here? What do you do to protect patient confidentiality and patient records?
It's critically important, obviously. There are additional risks. When you had a paper record system, it'd be very hard to steal all the paper records in a chart room. They just weigh too much. But if you inappropriately did a backup on a non-encrypted hard drive and then left that in your car and left the door open, then there's a risk of a massive privacy breach. There are those risks. On the other hand, through technology, there are many things that you can improve privacy protections. For example, in a paper world, you don't know who's looked at your chart. In a computerized world, you know exactly who has looked at your chart. There's a permanent trail of everyone who's looked at, changed, deleted, added stuff to your medical record, and you as the patient have the right to request that. You can limit what the clerical person sees in terms of the medical information in your chart, whereas with a paper record, that's not possible. You can encrypt the data so that people's identity, even if lost, can't be discerned.
Hmm. What's been your biggest challenge, do you think, at your center?
It's hard. I won't sugarcoat it. And we work with our practices so that everyone recognizes this is going to be a wrenching transformation. It's not impossible. It's just hard. But we have to build in that expectation.
What about cost? It would seem that for some of the larger healthcare agencies, having this sort of a system and the cost of implementing this kind of a system might be something that they could absorb certainly more easily than the smaller doctor's offices in this country. Even with government subsidies, do you think that that this is an expensive proposition for a lot of physicians?
I think the Recovery Act incentives, the physician payments that are in place for Medicare and Medicaid, essentially cover the dollar costs of the subsidy that would be needed to get physicians, even in small practices, to adopt. What they don't by themselves provide is the psychic cost, the psychological pain of going through this transformation on your own. And that's why the community projects, the local support and service organizations like ours, who hold hands with the practice, and we help all the small practices kind of march together. So I think that's probably as important as simply the dollars and cents.
What about folks who say $19 billion during a recession? Can we afford this right now?
I don't think we can afford not to do it. I think if we look at the long-term issues that we're trying to address, it's a smart investment. Not only does it create jobs today, it's the right kind of stimulus spending because it's the short-term spending that sets in place long-term efficiencies.
Dr. Farzad Mostashari is the Assistant Commissioner for the New York City Health Department and is implementing the city's electronic health records program. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a recovering sex addict and journalist documents the lives of other addicts and then relapses while doing so. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, tips from a financial planner. Back in a minute. Here and Now. The U.S. Supreme Court hears a case tomorrow that could dramatically change the landscape for political campaign ads. At issue is the 90-minute film titled Hillary the Movie, which came out during Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign.
She's deceitful. She'll make up any story, lie about anything, as long as it serves her purpose of the moment.
So who is the real Hillary Clinton? Is she a brilliant trailblazer poised to make history as the first female president? Or is she ruthless, cunning, dishonest, willing to do anything for power?
The conservative group Citizens United produced Hillary the Movie. The film did run in a few theaters, but when the group wanted to televise it, the court said no, declaring the film a political ad that would violate campaign finance laws if it aired on TV. Joining us is George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley, who's actually teaching about this. And Jonathan, that was Dick Morris we heard in that clip. He's a former advisor to Hillary and Bill Clinton, but he's since become a critic of them. And we hear from a slew of other anti-Clinton voices in this film, all pretty scathing. Jonathan, what's the Supreme Court case about, essentially?
Well, you're absolutely right. It's not exactly composed of the American Historical Society. You have people like Ann Coulter and others who are holding forth about how she looks in pantsuits. But it does happen to raise a rather problematic part of the federal law. Congress passed a bill that restricted the use of what are called treasury funds of a corporation. That is, when a corporation uses sort of general funds to make a piece of political advocacy. This group is saying, this is really a documentary. You just don't like our spin. But they're pointing to movies like Fahrenheit 9/11 that were treated as documentaries. So they're saying that this is simply unconstitutional when you just simply move certain documentaries over into this prohibited category. They also are expressly asking the court to overturn aspects of this law that has technical limitations on corporations that they feel is unconstitutional as applied. But at the heart of all this is a really intriguing question. Who really decides? Who sits there in this sort of Caesar-like function and says, Hillary the Movie is political advocacy, Fahrenheit 9/11 is a legitimate movie, and what's at stake here, of course, is this tight control that Congress has placed on who can give money and who can speak in certain ways during campaigning.
It also seems like this could have implications for journalism.
It does. You know, it's a very curious thing because you've got Ted Olson here who I was very surprised this group went to Ted Olson.
And he's arguing, we should say he's arguing the case for Citizens United before the Supreme Court tomorrow.
Yeah, I think that frankly was a strategic mistake because the group, they have a plausible claim here that this is not about politics, that this is not about Republican versus Democrat, and yet they go to Ted Olson, who is sort of the go-to guy for Republican causes. They should have just gone to a First Amendment person.
What are you focusing on in regards to this case with your students?
You know, we do what the Supreme Court justices do. We read all the briefs. We debate it. We hold a conference to determine how we vote. There was a question of whether we could view the movie in class. there is a chance that members of the court will do so. And there's a concern in the First Amendment community that what they don't want is a sort of new pornography test, which the court dealt with years ago when one of the justices said that, well, I can't really define pornography, but I know it when I see it. Mm-hmm. And they used to show pornographic films in the Supreme Court, and they'd go, yep, that looks like porno to me. We don't want that in when it comes to political speech, where they say, you know, I don't know what political speech is by definition, but I know it when I see it, and that's a political ad, because we really need bright lines in a country committed to free speech.
Mm. Any predictions, Jonathan?
It could go truly either way. Citizens United might have a very slight advantage here, but they're asking to overturn a previous case of the Supreme Court and or the expansion of another case. So the precedent is against them on this. But there's at least four justices on this court that would be highly inclined to support them. I think you'd be crazy to put a bet on this one.
All right. Jonathan Turley is a law professor at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Thanks for being with us.
My great pleasure.
Back in a bit, here and now. Watching your money shrink in the bad economy is something many of us are probably getting used to, but there are things you can do to protect your savings. David McPherson is a financial planner who writes an online column about finances for abcnews.com, and we turn to him with a few money management questions. David, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
You've written that people who are struggling financially right now are going to need to take action on their own. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think for a long time now, what's been happening is that we're becoming more and more responsible for our own financial well-being. You know, the decline of the traditional pension plan and the rise of the 401k is just one small sign that we're really on our own when it comes to ensuring our own financial security.
But we look at our 401ks and we get very discouraged.
Yeah, we certainly do. I mean, I get discouraged myself. I mean, I kind of an internal optimist, and a couple of weeks ago, I kind of stopped looking at my clients' portfolios and just looked at my own retirement savings account, and I have to say, I was looking at it and just thinking, what happened? It was devastating, you know, and I'm sharing in everyone's pain.
So how should people take action to be more responsible for their financial well-being then?
Well, the number one thing is, you know, you just have to save on your own. You know, a lot of people right now, their gut reaction is to stop contributing to a 401k or an IRA because they feel like, you know, they're throwing good money after bad. But actually, that's exactly the wrong instinct, because right now, if you're investing in a mutual fund, you're buying shares at a price, you know, half the cost of what they were, say, 18 months ago. And if you wait until you think it's safe, then you've missed out on an opportunity to buy low and sell high. And so you need a balanced approach, and, you know, maybe I think what's going to happen now is, you know, there's going to be a little less emphasis on stocks and more on bonds and cash.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that people are moving away then from more riskier investments?
Yeah, I think certainly, you know, interest in things like hedge funds and private equity and emerging markets, some of the investment categories that did really well up until recently, I think people are going to shy away from that and kind of, you know, go for the plain vanilla investments, which is kind of what I believe in. You know, I'm kind of a boring, plain vanilla investor myself, and I think, you know, that's what we're going to be gravitating towards.
Hmm. What about home buying right now? It's spring, traditionally the home season of the year for folks. Does the same sort of philosophy apply there? You're saying, yes, we should invest now because you can buy low. Well, there are some houses you can buy low now as well. Would you say that the same kind of rules apply?
I wouldn't, you know, suggest somebody go out and buy a house, you know, if they can't afford it, because that's what got us into trouble. But if you've got the you know, the income in a stable job, I actually do think it's a good time to be looking. Congress, you know, has approved a tax credit for first-time home buyers that can save you, you know, up to $8,000 on a home purchase. And, you know, that's a terrific opportunity. And my understanding is that's going to expire near the end of the year.
But what about the folks who are struggling?
For the folks who are struggling, you know, I'd say shore up your, you know, your basic finances, pay down any debt you have, certainly pay off credit cards. That would be the first thing I'd look to. And then if you, you know, once the debt's under control, you know, try to put away more of a cash cushion. You know, if you are, you know, if you do want to buy a home, you know, the banks are a lot tougher these days, and so they're going to want a bigger down payment. So maybe you can't do it this year and get that $8,000 credit. However, you should be working on building up that down payment or building up your rainy day fund.
What about the new program from the Obama administration, that Making Homes Affordable program? Mm-hmm. It is supposed to help people refinance. Is that something that you would encourage people to look into, and what should they know about that?
Well, it's first thing I'd keep in mind is, you know, this was just announced, and the details are still being worked out. So if you call your bank or somebody looking for help and they don't give you an answer today, well, I wouldn't give up. I'd keep trying, because I think it's going to take a while for that to work its way through the system. But I think that's something you just can't give up on. I've been getting a lot of email the last few weeks on this issue, and they say, oh, I've called my bank, I called Fannie Mae, and nobody could help me. And they're probably entirely correct. And you know what? They got to call back in 2 weeks. And if they don't get a straight answer, then they got to call back 2 weeks later. You have to be current on your payments, and your loan has to be owned by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac.
Now, how do people know if their loan is owned by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac?
Well, the first thing to do is to call the company that you're sending your payment to. Just because, you know, you may be sending your payment to, you know, a bank in your area that you're familiar with, that doesn't mean the bank actually owns the mortgage. They're just what they call the loan servicer. So call up the loan company and say, does Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac own the loan? There's a good chance that your mortgage is owned by one of those two agencies and you have no idea.
Mm-hmm. You know, aside from the home program, I've seen other advertisements about, for example, putting in replacement windows and getting a tax credit because you'll be more energy efficient. Do you have general advice that you give to folks about some of these ads saying that they're going to help people because of the economy and help people because of the new programs in Washington?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the energy improvements, I mean, there is a tax credit that I think will cover up to 30% of your costs for, you know, energy improvements in your home. And though I think those are legitimate, what you have to watch out for is anyone that wants to charge you a fee to modify your loan or to refinance. HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, has contracted with housing agencies all over the country to work with people on these issues at no cost. They're called HUD-approved counselors, and they're agencies in every state contracted to do the work.
Mm-hmm. It is tax season, obviously. The deadline is approaching. Do you think it's wise right now to try to have a professional do your taxes because there are all these sort of new rules that you have to navigate?
It depends on your situation. I mean, there are some categories of folks where I think it definitely makes sense to hire somebody. Those would be people like, you know, self-employed folks, you know, who own their own businesses, who, you know, are eligible to deduct a number of their expenses, but, you know, trying to figure out the rules can be a nightmare. Also, if you're self-employed, you're probably better off focusing on your business and let somebody who specializes in taxes do that for you. Another category of folks would be people who own investment property. Maybe they own a second home and, you know, they use it part of the year for their own personal vacations, but they also rent it out part of the year. There are very complex rules for vacation properties versus investment properties, and if you fall into one of those categories, I would definitely look at hiring somebody.
Okay, so overall, invest now if you can. Don't go too risky. Look into the several federal programs that are available. Have patience with some of them, but there are many available, and you should look into whether you qualify or you can apply for some of these things. Is that your overall advice, or how would you sum it up?
Yeah, I mean, there are programs beginning to emerge, and I would, you know, look around. Nobody's going to come knocking on your door or calling you on the phone to say, hey, you're eligible for this. You really got to take the initiative and hunt these things down on your own.
David McPherson, financial planner based on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. He also writes an online financial planning column for ABC News. David, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Deb.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. Alaskans woke this morning to an erupting volcano. Mount Redoubt, about 100 miles southwest of Anchorage, erupted four times overnight. It's Alaska's first volcanic eruption in 20 years, and John Power, a geophysicist at the Alaska Volcano Observatory, says it's a big one.
These are large explosive eruptions that are throwing ash plumes, plumes of volcanic ash, up to as high as 50,000 feet. So very significant explosive eruptions of the volcano.
Wind patterns are pushing the volcano's ash cloud north away from Anchorage, which is the state's largest city. And northern cities are reporting a shower of fine gray ash. The principal threat right now, says Power, is to aircraft.
Ash clouds are very, very hazardous to the operation of aircraft.
Because of the ash threat, Alaska Airlines has canceled 19 flights in and out of Anchorage International Airport, and officials at Elmendorf Air Force Base in Anchorage say their planes have been grounded and are being sheltered for now. The 10,000-foot-high Mount Redoubt volcano last erupted during a four-month period in 1989 and 90. In January of this year, when the volcano became restless, scientists at the observatory warned that an eruption could occur at any time. And Power says it could be a while before the volcano calms down.
We would expect Redoubt to have some level of eruptive activity over the next weeks to months, although, you know, there's nothing to say that this one can't write a slightly different script.
Increased earthquake activity over the past 48 hours prompted scientists to raise the alert level for Mount Redoubt. Yesterday morning, 40 to 50 minor earthquakes were being recorded every hour. In England, Jade Goody is being called a Princess Diana from the wrong side of the tracks. Tributes are pouring in from the Prime Minister down to fans leaving flowers outside the home of Britain's best-known reality TV star. Jade Goody died from cervical cancer yesterday. She was 27 years old. Goody burst onto the reality TV scene in 2002 when she joined the show Big Brother, where contestants are constantly filmed as they live together for weeks. She became something of a national touchstone, sparking debate about race, class, and celebrity. The BBC's Vincent Dowd prepared this report on Jade Goody's life and death.
Jade Goody was born in South London in 1981. Her teenage father was already rattled with the drugs which later killed him. Her educational career went nowhere. Leaving school, she became a dental nurse. 7 years ago, craving excitement and escape, Jade Goody applied for the British reality TV show. Big Brother's audiences loved Jade Goody's energy, though at times they were astounded, as when she didn't know Eastern England is sometimes called East Anglia.
Is there not a place called East Anglia there abroad?
Jade, have you been taking stupid pills
again? I swear! Every time someone used the word East Anglia, I actually think that they're talking about, you know, aeroplane business, like loads of flights, like next to Tunisia and places like that. Am I really thick?
She didn't put on the show. She didn't put on the act. That was Jade Goody.
Journalist Andrew Pearce.
Damaged vulnerability and this brassy self-confidence. It was a mixture of the two. It won over the public and it made her an extraordinary money-making machine.
She was utterly and immediately at ease amid the marketing maelstrom. Perfume, exercise videos, books of memoirs. Jade was now a welcome and well-paid guest on TV shows.
Jade, in 2005, the number one is called Is This the Way to Wear?
Oh, Alabama. Amaricious, Amaricious, please.
Amarillo.
She had two sons with fellow reality TV contestant Jeff Brazier. In 2007, she went on Celebrity Big Brother, no longer a mere member of the public, but a terrible stumble ensued. There were ugly, hysterical rants against the Indian movie actress Shilpa Shetty.
Did you only all do the Oxo cubes?
You know what? I don't need to dignify this stupid, stupid argument. It may be
caused
fun for you,
Jade. Caused by you, because you said the only thing you ordered was Oxo cubes, which is
oh,
an out and out
shut
lie.
Up.
Out and out lie.
Shut up.
No, I won't shut up. You shut up. You might
don't
be some princess in Neverland. You're not no princess here. You're a normal housemate like everybody else.
please, get some, learn some manners.
Andrew Pierce of the Daily Telegraph believes the fury and racism targeted at the Bollywood star exposed aspects of the UK the media like to ignore.
That side of her is not uncommon in certain white, working-class, run-down parts of urban London and urban inner cities. You hear that view articulated quite frequently. She said what came into her head, which often wasn't very clever.
Needing a career lift last summer, she went to India to feature in the version there of Big Brother called Big Boss.
Hi, I'm Jane Goody, and what happened between me and Shilpa Shetty is in the past, and I'm not proud of it.
Poonam Saxena, TV critic of the Hindustan Times, says on Celebrity Big Brother, she'd represented a Britain Indians seldom encounter.
Who would you see in India? You would see politicians who are visiting, maybe some, you know, writers or university professors or people like that, really. We don't really see too many of people like Jade Goody here. So I think she was pretty much an unknown quantity for Indian readers and viewers.
Jade, jo hai, Big Boss ki pehli international mehman hongi.
Shortly into the series, though, came shocking news. Doctors in London confirmed to Jade she had cervical cancer.
The way I'm dealing with it is my own way of dealing with things, and it's like putting on a smile and having a little laugh about it. That's how I do with it. And I do believe that laughing is a great cure, so I'm just going to laugh my way through this, and hopefully in the operation and the intensive care, I'm laughing.
But the cancer was diagnosed as terminal. Every detail was hugely publicised, and some saw echoes of the reaction to the death of the Princess of Wales. Jade Goody's life followed a near-perfect arc for the modern media. A wretched start, then fame and fortune, then early death. With the end approaching, she married and then got baptised, always with the cameras present. Some thought it all tasteless, but Andrew Pierce says at the end what mattered to her was her son's future.
She wanted to better herself. She wanted to better her children. She worked like a Trojan in the last weeks of her life to pay for a proper education for her children. She had no proper education. She was determined her sons would have a better chance in life than she had.
In the 1940s, when George Orwell created the original Big Brother, he feared the unwanted intrusion of an all-seeing eye into lives most people then kept private. Jade Goody's life and sad death seem to show people private no longer, in fact, permanently ready for their close-up.